This is a special recording of Taste Matters, part of a series in conjunction with the opening of the Next World's Fair, Expo Milano 2015, where the U.S. will be participating with the USA Pavilion, themed American Food 2.0, United to Feed the Planet.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And as you know, well, actually, as it used to be, once every week on Wednesdays, we would host this show about my favorite subject and yours, taste in the biggest sense. And for the last few weeks, we have been doing a series about Expo Milano 2015. For those of you who don't know or haven't been listening, Expo Milano is the next World's Fair. And yes, in fact, we continue to produce World's Fairs, or the world does, let's say. We, that is the United States, has a sketchy recent history about participation in the fairs. But this time around, as you'll learn with my guest today, there's a unique situation, a unique thing going on, and that is that the theme of this World's Fair, which is happening in Milan, opening May 1st, just a few days, probably from today, if depending on when you're listening to this podcast, is Feeding the Planet, Energy for Life. So the theme of the whole fair is food. And although you don't know that we still do World's Fairs, most likely, 147 countries are participating this year in Milan. The United States is just one of them, but we're coming in a big way, in some ways in a bigger way than we have been in the last few decades. And we're coming with this notion of what we're calling American Food 2.0. And that idea is that in the last few years, the last few decades, let's say, food in America has evolved from what it, I don't even know if it ever was, but from what people thought it was, fast, convenient, industrial, what have you. And as those of you listening to certainly this show on Heritage Radio Network, you know of a different type of food, a different type of American food that is what we wanted to bring to the world. But the context, again, of World's Fair is, I think, one that is endlessly fascinating. And the United States, although we don't have a good recent history, has a long and sort of important history in World's Fairs. And today I'm really grateful to have with me someone who is very familiar with that history, who is a historian, actually, an associate professor of history at Drexel University, Scott Knowles. So thank you for joining us, because I think that listeners really want to know a little bit more about what these fairs are, what they were, and what they've come to be for the United States. So thanks for being here.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. I never get tired of talking about World's Fairs, so this is a great chance to talk some more.
Good. So set us up. What we found in going around with this fair, I mean, I'm the chief creative officer of the USA Pavilion this time around, and everywhere I go to talk about it, if anyone knows that World's Fairs ever existed, they think of 1964 in New York, because we're based in New York here, as probably the last one, or if they were international, 67 Expo in Montreal. But set us up in why these things were at one time really important for everyone participating and continue to be for some countries, maybe more than others.
Well, first of all, I wonder if you feel the weight of history on your shoulders a bit in your role, given that Buckminster Fuller and Daniel Burnham and Robert Moses also held similar positions of responsibility. So, the idea that Americans have lost a bit of interest, perhaps, in the World's Fair doesn't negate the long history of the genre. And I think if we, sort of revisit it a bit, maybe we could recapture some of that enthusiasm. You know, as fairs, trade fairs and trade shows go back into the early 19th century, Paris and London, and in New York too, in places that had, goods to sell, enough people to gather together to exhibit these goods, we start to see what you might call trade fairs. It wasn't until 1851 that we see the first what we call a World's Fair, and that was in London. It was called the Crystal Palace Exhibition. It was held in Hyde Park. They had to get special permission to put up a temporary building. It turned out to be not so temporary, although it was destroyed in the 30s. But an enormous industrial structure made of cast iron and glass, which was put there to demonstrate wares, to demonstrate manufactured goods, but at the same time it was putting on display modernity, if you will, or early modernity, and a particular sort of version of industrialization as spectacle. New York followed suit just 2 years later, not wanting to be left out, and in fact, in 1853, New York held its own Crystal Palace at Bryant Park. And they built a structure there, which stood until it burned down 5 years later. And they also had a viewing tower there that was 315 feet high. It was actually higher than the spire of Trinity Church. And so visitors for many years could come and converge on Bryant Park. And what were they seeing? Well, a lot of what they were seeing were manufactured goods, machines and goods. But you know, you didn't in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, ever get away from that sort of close fit between technology and the nation. So everybody knew by the names that were on the manufacturers, by the names that were on the machines, and by the flags that were strewn everywhere, where these things were coming from. So, you know, the 19th century fairs, and the most famous of which are Philadelphia in 1876, the Centennial Exposition there, the 1889 fair in Paris, which was marked by the construction of the Eiffel Tower, the sort of ultimate symbol, you know, of kind of the conquest of nature by steel, you know, rising up, which now has become sort of iconic figure.
It was an eyesore at the time, I understand. People didn't thought it was an ugly sort of tower monstrosity.
There was a lot of debate over whether or not, you know, Gustav Eiffel had left an eyesore on the landscape or whether or not it would be a lasting landmark. Of course, I think history has decided that a bit. But you know, you get this cluster of fairs then from 1851 up until the late 19th century, which are very striking in that they demonstrate new types of architecture that hadn't been seen before. That is, the sort of prefabricated iron and steel, the idea that you could put together a very large structure in a short period of time with a lot of load-bearing done by iron and steel and glass. You know, and these are cities which were masonry cities and wood cities up to this point. So in some ways, the architecture of these fairs and what's inside the buildings are showing a way towards an industrial future and a sort of industrial aesthetic in the architecture. So that's kind of late 19th century picture.
So I imagine from that moment, and so you enter the 20th century and the progressive era, and then, correct me if I'm wrong, America's participation increased in the early 20th century when it comes to these expositions. And what was, tell me a little bit about America's history, both in hosting and in participating, and I imagine a country, you know, just because I know America well, and now even more in the context of the World's Fair, trying to find a place for itself or to assert a leader role in some ways that I imagine was probably behind much of the history.
Yeah, I mean, nationalism, you never get far away from it. And, you know, the 1876 fair in Philadelphia is a good example. They had a manufacturer's hall and a machinery hall. And the machinery hall was, again, it was full of machines from all over the world. But they were all hooked up to an American-made steam engine, the Corliss engine, which was the largest engine. At the time, it was festooned with eagles and flags and painted red, white, and blue, and President Grant fired it up in 1876, and it was this engine that powered all the other machinery in the hall. So you couldn't escape this idea that Americans, at least, were putting forward the notion that the industrial engine of the future is going to be an American engine.
I just have to add one thing, because as you keep talking, the similarities between then and now are so clear to me, but General Electric is one of the main sponsors of our pavilion at Expo Milano, and their Jenbacher, which is a biodiesel engine they want to power the future, is going to be on display at our pavilion. I mean, it's kind of amazing 150 years later to have the same assertions being made. Well, anyway.
No, that's extra. I can't wait to see it. I mean, we could move it forward to 1893, which is probably the most famous American fairs in 1964, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but 1893 in Chicago, the Columbian Exposition, which was meant to be in 1892 to, you know, do an anniversary of Columbus' arrival in the New World. It took them a little bit longer to pull the thing together, but this is a tremendous undertaking designed by Daniel Burnham, the architect and landscape planner, and Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park. And the concept there was the White City. So Beaux-Arts architecture, a lot of neoclassical themes, this great central lagoon, and these buildings literally all painted white, and the electricity was the central feature. So everybody at the Columbian Exposition was waiting for sundown, and as the sun would go down, everybody would sort of wait, and then they would turn the key, and all the lights would come on. And in fact, it was the largest electrified city in the world. And there was a city within a city, a city within Chicago. And of course, what's on display is General Electric, Westinghouse, you know, the major manufacturers of the day of electricity, and showing Americans what an electrified urban future was going to look like. Now, I've written a bit about this on the sort of dark side of this, which is that there was also a lot of trepidation about the safety of electricity at the time. And in fact, the fire insurance industry was very concerned that these electrical wires and the sockets and the bulbs would malfunction and burn the whole thing down. And so that, you know, you always get this sort of, you know, enthusiasm with technology tempered with reality, or this sort of questioning of, are we moving into a safe and sane technological future? But certainly, American pride wrapped around the idea that we could conquer darkness through electricity. Move it forward a little bit, you get to 1901, the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo. Also, major themes around power production, around electricity, around mobility, you know, transportation. That was a pretty grim fair in the sense that the President McKinley was assassinated at that fair. But it didn't temper enthusiasm for the genre. I mean, just a few years later, 1904, the Lewis and Clark Exposition takes place in St. Louis. And then probably the most famous, there's a couple of quick ones in the 1930s, the Century of Progress Fair in Chicago in 1933, and then the New York World's Fair in 1939. And both of those, we begin to see a shift away from sort of technology in an amorphous kind of nationalist sense, and a move more towards technology as corporate. And you get a lot more corporate pavilions in 33 and particularly in 39, so that technology isn't just in a machinery hall or an electricity hall as it was in 1893, but now you have a General Electric pavilion, you have a Westinghouse pavilion, you have these, you know, big corporate firms beginning to demonstrate what the future might look like. It's not just technology and democracy in the United States, it's also corporate technology within a democratic structure, which, you know, in the middle of the New Deal, in the middle of the Great Depression, was kind of a bold statement to make when it looked like technology and democracy and capitalism had failed a bit.
Right. Although prescient, considering this year's fair involves corporate pavilions, involves even the country pavilions are obviously supported by corporations, ours being unique in that we're the only country that can't fund it from state or from national level federal funds, but has to raise the money from the corporate sector in public-private partnership. But even those that do contribute, those states that do contribute to their pavilions, they all have corporate sponsors and corporate pavilions. China has four pavilions, two of them corporate, one of them about Chinese corporations, and one of them the national pavilion. So that hasn't changed either.
Right.
Amazing.
Right. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of concern, of course, as to whether or not the federal government should be funding these. The story actually is a little more complex. I mean, in the United States, the federal government has rarely funded them much. The imprimatur of the State Department, of course, on the thematics is important. And opening the doors to corporate funding, of course, is important. But in fact, the earlier fairs often had subscription. Either a city would do a bond issue, or there would be a private World's Fair corporation that would be founded, often both. And then they would ask the federal government for some limited funds. But the enthusiasm for these fairs was so great that there was a general sense that investors could make their money back. They didn't until 1933, but in fact, 1933 fair did pay dividends. So it was shown to be possible that it's kind of a win-win-win, right? It was a boost for national pride, it was a boost for the city, and you could make some money at the same time. So as we, you know, sort of come right up to the verge of World War II, World's Fairs, by that point, 75 years of the genre, they are city builders, they demonstrate national pride, they demonstrate technological progress, and they're a sort of really kind of profitable pop culture venue. I mean, tens of millions of people are attending these fairs by this point, the most widely attended spectacles in the world to that time.
Wow. So then the war comes, and I've spoken to many people who, well, not many, but several people who attended the 39 World's Fair here in New York and remember when the pavilion started closing because different countries were entering into war, literally, right up through the 1940 when the whole fair closed. What happens with the history of the expos then after the war?
I think that it's tremendous you got to speak with some people about it, you know, because it's a really jarring disjuncture between, you know, all these flags of the world flying and enthusiasm for, you know, small world and everybody, you know, marching into the future, the technological progress, and then in September of 39, of course, that all collapses. There was a fair planned for Rome in 1942. Obviously, it didn't happen. And World's Fairs basically go on hiatus. There were a couple small ones after the war. The first big one wasn't until 1958 in Brussels. And that's an interesting one. It was very ambitious. The Belgians had done several World's Fairs up to that time, but that was the most high-profile one. And, you know, it's interesting aesthetically. The most famous pavilion there is called the Atomium. It was a huge model of an atom. The United States and the Soviet Union pavilions sort of faced each other in this sort of Cold War standoff. There was a model of Sputnik was on display, which then went missing, apparently, and the Soviets apparently blamed the United States for stealing the Sputnik. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, kind of silly intrigues, but it was a huge grounds, very well attended, and I think when we sort of look at these post-war fairs, we start seeing the thematics shift a little bit. I mean, the Cold War ones obviously have this sort of jockeying for technological supremacy aspect, but you start to get into futuristic thematics, talking about space, talking about electronics. The aesthetics, the art aesthetics and the architectural aesthetics now move into sort of modern and what we might even call sort of postmodern aesthetics. You know, the displays of art are now very modern. The buildings are no longer just the old industrial steel and glass. Now we're moving into different kinds of shapes, different kinds of materials. They become very interesting in that regard. Seattle held a fair in 62. The Space Needle is the iconic, you know, signature architectural achievement of that. And, you know, we were in the middle of getting into the middle of the space race there. So the fairs, while they continue to be nationalistic and technology heavy, they also are focusing a bit forward now. Not so much just marking, you know, 100-year anniversary of Lewis and Clark or 100-year anniversary of, you know, the Bastille. Now they're looking into some sort of a future, which is a little murky in 1962 or 1964. But people seem to know it's still going to be marked by, you know, democracy, we hope, in the West, technology, corporations, and now some sort of unknown but hopeful future for the 1960s. And that's sort of the interesting themes that we begin to encounter at that point.
So we'll get back to 64 because I think it's an important starting point. I'm talking with Scott Knowles, Associate Professor of History from Drexel University, about the history of World's Fairs. You're listening to Taste Matters. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and we are talking with Scott Knowles, who's the Associate Professor of History at Drexel University, about the history of World's Fairs. This is part of our special series on Expo Milano and the American Pavilion. As I said earlier, I'm the Chief Creative Officer of America's participation in the next World's Fair, which opens May 1st and runs through October 31st in Milan. The theme is food and how we will feed the future, and each of the 147 countries participating is trying to address from their unique perspective that question in some way about how we will, as a global community, feed the expected 9 billion people by the year 2050. Before we get back into it and pick up the conversation about the 64 World's Fair, I want to remind people listening that if you have questions or you're interested in more information, you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN, where we are always trying to give to you interesting tidbits about some of the topics that we've been covering over the last few years. So we're in the 60s, Scott, and I mean, 64 stands out mostly, I think, because, well, I hear Belgian waffles were a hit, and and there are some other food memories. But I guess there's probably in New York anyway, where most of the people working on this project are based. There's just a strong cultural resonance, whether you were kids and you went, or you had day passes, or your parents met and took a date there, or something like that. So, but it was unique in many ways, not the least of which was Robert Moses and his hand on top of it. So tell us a little bit about that, and then take us to the present time.
Well, the 64 Fair looms large in collective New Yorkers' memory, for sure. And Robert Moses, this was his second crack at a World's Fair. 39 was the first one. It's a bookend of his career to a certain degree. It also shows the lack of patience that Moses had. He wasn't really willing to work through the Bureau of International Exposition's process. He just said, well, we'll do it however we want to do it, you know, very Moses. By that point in his career, we'll let it run more that, you know, the BIE says they can only be 6 months long. He said, we'll do it 2 years. But what, you know, Moses saw the fair as an attempt to finish his project in Flushing, you know, in Corona Park and Flushing Meadows. And, you know, it succeeded in that regard, I suppose. And it succeeded, like, you know, lots of the post-war fairs, to bring together a lot of these, you know, big corporate pavilions. One that people spent a lot of time remarking on was the General Motors Pavilion, which had its Futurama exhibition, where a visitor would be seated and would move in sort of a moving chair around this diorama that laid out the city, and then you traveled from the city into the suburban areas and then into the countryside. And of course, the sort of focus on mobility and the focus on the future of mobility with General Motors, it's a win-win, right? And this is before any oil crisis had settled into the American consciousness and before environmental concerns. However, it wasn't lost on people that the 64 Fair didn't seem to capture people's imagination the way some of the earlier fairs had. It was disappointing. Not as many people came as Moses thought. And people who were, I've studied a little bit about planning for a Philadelphia fair that was supposed to happen in 76, and people from Philadelphia came up, the planners, and they went to the 64 Fair, and they came away a little cold. They said, wow, we're not really sure if these corporate pavilions and this sort of hyper-focus on technology, if that's going to continue to sustain people's interest in the age of television. And as the 64-65 fair wound down, the United States is entering the war in Vietnam, the civil rights movement is starting, cities are starting to erupt into violence, and, you know, this sort of American enthusiasm for the fair is this sort of signature urban expression of modernity and hopefulness, and it starts to erode a little bit. So there's that pushback that we begin to see. Philadelphia actually failed in its ability to host a fair. They carted it all up, boxed it all up by 1972 and gave up on the idea, as a matter of fact. Seattle had a fair, had a fair in 62. That one seemed to be successful. 64 was not as successful as people thought. Montreal had one in 67, which is a turning point in some ways because the thematics changed. The theme of that one was man and his world. So a movement away from this idea of letting corporations kind of run the fair and having a much more sort of expansive, I guess we could say the 1960s has about five decades packed into it. And from 1964 to 5 to 67, you do begin to see this shift, you know, in these themes. The United States does have a few fairs after that. There's one in Spokane in 74. There's one in Knoxville in 82. And then the last one that's been held in the United States was in New Orleans in 1984, and that one had the dubious distinction of going bankrupt before it was over and had to be bailed out by the citizens of Louisiana. So it's a real question that those of us who study this is sort of like, what happens, you know, from 64, when it still seems to be going pretty well, to 84, when it's over? And I guess it sort of opens questions about, you know, is it television that killed the World's Fair?
International travel?
Right, you know, or maybe is sort of the a decline of nationalism, although that doesn't seem to be too much on the wane, but maybe in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't as much, you know, national pride around technology, the sort of the end of the Vietnam War. I think those are probably all, in some ways, realistic ideas. But I think there's some other themes that you have to look at, which really have much more to do with globalization. The idea that corporations don't just represent one nation anymore from the 1960s forward. And also the rise of East Asia. East Asian fairs, you know, the great majority of world's fairs up to the 60s are held in Europe and the United States. They really define the genre in the ways that we've been discussing. In 1970, there's an Osaka World's Fair. Tens of millions of people go. It's a way to demonstrate the rise of Japan out of the ashes of World War II. They have another one in Okinawa, of all places, really extraordinary, on the theme of the oceans in 1975. Really remarkable fair. Not much has been written about it. Korea, Japan hosts several in the 70s and 80s. Korea begins to host fairs. Australia is hosting fairs. And Europe continues to, as it moves out of the Cold War, but not just in the sort of traditional places like London or Paris, but now we're starting to see them in places like Spain, which holds two. Germany hosts one. And that brings us sort of up to the present. And, you know, as we were discussing before, you tell Americans, hey, I'm going to the World's Fair. They say, what's a World's Fair? You say, oh, World's Fair, like the one they had in 2010, where 70 million people came. These are the largest events. These are the largest number of people attending any kind of global event is still a World's Fair, except for Disney. Disney, I think, is about 120 million people go to Disney every year. But some of these fairs now are getting, they're averaging between 40 and 70 million people attending. So I don't think we can say that the genre is done. It's just that Americans are, you know, the United States is no longer the central locus of where they're taking place.
And yet again, I'm amazed in listening to you describe the history at how much of what is happening at this particular World's Fair continues to resonate, whether it's that negotiation between the public and private sector, the individual countries, or the global community, or even what role technology will play. That fear you mentioned about technology, and in this case, we're talking about internet and privacy issues and all those sorts of things. Then, of course, there's ISIS in Europe and the challenges that people see in gathering a group of people together in the middle of Europe in that way. I'm even stunned the American Pavilion is going to include a restaurant in central Milan, much like the James Beard House here, where we're bringing guest chefs in the Galleria in the center of the city. And the ironwork was done by Eiffel for that Galleria that you see in the restaurant space. So there are so many sort of resonances with the past and the current situation. And in some ways, I think the Milan Fair, because of the theme they've chosen, of feeding the planet, almost harks back to another time when one answer might be genetic engineering and technologies about food and distribution, all those sorts of things. But the other answer might be heirloom, traditional farming, you know, and the debate that the tension between those two ideas of what the future holds. But still people wonder if anyone will care. I mean, it's been hard for us to get people here to understand and care, although the theme of food helps. Food's always been important, but no one fair has ever been themed around food in general, whether it's the Belgian waffles in 64 or the French restaurant in 39 or all the things that people talk about. So I wonder if you could give us a little perception from what you know, just what the future of World's Fairs might be. Hard question to ask a historian. I know they hate those kinds of questions, but is there a resonance in today's age where we are so connected, where I can tweet something and a friend in Japan knows it before my next door neighbor knows it? What role does a World's Fair play in this world?
Well, I'm a historian who doesn't mind talking about the future, so I appreciate the question. One thing I would note is that, particularly in the earlier fairs, agriculture played a huge role. And agriculture pavilions and seeds and, you know, the idea of mechanizing farm work was and I'm wondering if that will play out as a theme. I'll be really fascinated to see those resonances with the contemporary fair. So
it's actually in our pavilion. That's fantastic. They're one of the people speaking in our farming pod is the largest producer of carrots in the world, and no hands touch those carrots before they're packaged.
robotic yeah. farm work, yeah. Right? So that's a theme to trace forward, I think. But you know, to your question about, you know, whither the fair and the future of the fair. I mean, I think there's still going to be 20 to 30 million people attend this fair, probably. Mm-hmm. It's almost always been the case that the majority of people who attend the fairs are in the countries or close by. But that doesn't blunt the impact on culture because, you know, every country will put together, most countries will put together a pavilion. The United States will have a role to play. The perception of the United States in Europe today will be shaped by what's on those grounds. And, you know, people as early as the 20s were lamenting this. Oh, well, radio and movies are going to put the World's Fair out of business, you know, and then international travel in the 50s is going to put the World's Fair. Nobody will care to go to these old-fashioned trade shows. And then, of course, television was a great concern. But I think that we have to continue to leave a place for the idea that people like to go to a physical space where they can walk around and experience things in three dimensions with all the visceral, the sights and the smells and the sounds and the chance encounters that these kinds of things, like going to an Olympics or going to a World Cup or going to Disney World or going to a World's Fair, can render. And I think that's one of the main reasons that people still do go. Mm-hmm. We also are beginning to see, despite the fact that Congress has officially barred congressional support since the late 90s for a World's Fair, American cities are putting together bids. Right? So there was an attempt for a Silicon Valley bid. I know we were discussing Minnesota has been talking about one. I think for 2025, we're looking at Houston and San Francisco are putting together bids. So, you know, this idea of a World's Fair, very much like an Olympics, I think, as an event where you can put a date on the calendar and you can bring the planning, architecture, economic development communities of your city and your state together around a sort of a big event, that hasn't lost its currency. I think that continues to be important. I mean, maybe there's some renewal in the capacity of cities to do this sort of thing, too. I mean, from the 60s to the 90s, pretty grim times for American cities. But American urban populations are growing again in a robust way. So that's important. And I think, you know, to your opening comments, which were really, I think, spot on about this idea of slow food, you know, this hyper-connected world that we live in is also, I think, causing a little bit of pushback around the idea of slow culture. And this idea that we can be live-tweeting something, but it's also fun to be in a group of people while we're live-tweeting something. So just because we're digitally connected doesn't mean that physically going to a place ceases to be an important part of the human experience. Now, to the extent that World's Fairs can facilitate that and can kind of harness that desire to be connected sort of virtually and physically, I think they will continue to succeed. And there's no shortage of proposals out there.
Right, and no shortage of gatherings and festivals and all the sorts of things that live as much in real space as they do in cyberspace. This is actually the first World's Fair connected in the social world in some ways. I mean, 2010 in Shanghai, what could have been also, but things are much more involved, and that was in China, and that had its limitations. So they're expecting 1 billion people to tune in and to see what's happening there, in addition to the 20 or 30 million people on the ground. I guess for the last comment, one of the things that's been our biggest challenge, as I said a few times, is convincing people that this is a relevant thing to raise money on and to use as a form of expression of American culture and even to help sway what people think about us in the world. And that's true more so in America than it is among, let's say, State Department people out in the field doing public diplomacy or all the sorts of things that happen. And I wonder if you could comment, just for my sake, on what you think the opportunity is for America or for any country to participate in this day and age in these sorts of things from the historical perspective, but again, sort of with an eye to the future.
Well, the opportunity, maybe it sounds a little old-fashioned, but, you know, this idea of cultural exchange is as important now than it's ever been. I mean, I think with the end of the Cold War in the 90s, there was a sort of renewal of interest in this idea of cultural exchange. And now, again, even though, as you said, there may be 1 billion people tuning in, the content on the ground still matters. Tuning in to what? And I think that's where it is really important for people in your position to put together a creative package that really shows. And I think right now what would be particularly important is to show that the United States can balance a broader concern with humanity with the more sort of nuts and bolts concerns about growing the economy. And that's tricky, right? I mean, food encompasses both of those things. It's the largest global industry. And it's also the largest aspect, or one of the largest aspects, of global culture. Can we balance those two things in a way that's also interesting, and can people can come away from it and feel like, wow, that was important. I participated in something. My own experience, I've only been to one. I'll be going to Milan with
that's
a group.
One more than I did.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, maybe that's why you accepted. When I went to Shanghai with a group of students from Drexel University in 2010, I'd never been to one. I knew a lot of the history. But walking through those grounds was a mind-blowing experience. And to me, the USA Pavilion in 2010 left me a little cold. It didn't really embrace everything. It didn't really maximize the potential, I think, to show the United States as an economic engine, but also as a cultural engine. And that's a much longer story than your audience has time for today. But I think the planning for this go-round has been much better and much more rooted in really sort of trying to really be aware of this audience. And I think there's going to be a bigger sort of, obviously, a much larger Western audience for this fair. It was a little harder to do the planning, I think with Shanghai. And that's the potential that's there. Will it also boost interest in the United States in terms of travel, in terms of buying American products? The data is there. World's fairs, like Olympics, it's a mixed bag in terms of if they're good for the host city. It depends on how long you look. Within 5 to 10 years, it's not so clear if they're good. They cause a lot of traffic. They cause a lot of displacement. They make people kind of mad. But if you look longer term, 15, 20 years, there's often a lot of return on investment for cities. So I think that's a reason for Americans to look at what's happening in these other venues and think about having them back here. I think the Milanese will be happy that they did it. And if the Americans put on a good show, which I'm sure they will, then that's also going to maybe provoke Italians to want to go to the United States and visit some of these cities that they're, you know, see on TV, but they want to walk around the actual streets. Again, maybe I'm old-fashioned in that regard, but I think we can use this as a way to get the world interested again in what American, not just our economy, but our culture has to offer.
Great. Well, I hope that is true, and I know we will see you in Milan at least, and I hope that people listening will join us. And again, Expo Milano runs from May 1st to October 31st. It's 6 months around the theme of food, and everyone is welcome to come. It's going to be quite a celebration and culturally interesting. Thank you, Scott, for joining us. I've learned a lot more, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about in Milan and beyond to see where this fits in the history and culture of World's Expositions. You are listening to Taste Matters
on Heritage Radio
Network. Thanks.
Do you want to try that again? Do you want to try that one more time?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Thanks. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. This is Heritage Radio Network.